Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, present the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for autumn semester 2025.
Today, financial institutions and intermediation. This is a fairly short lecture. We'll go have a look at the numbers, and then we will do the last part of Chapter 2, and then you will have a quiz. Now, you're allowed to use your notes on your quiz. This is not a lockdown browser. I'll do that from now on, but the first one, I still have a few people who haven't been able to get the lockdown browser to work, but we'll get you there as quickly as we can. Come to my office if during my office hours. I'm here about every day in the mornings, but just check in with me and I'll get you through the lockdown browser. And also, next week I will show you how to put your LinkedIn account, your personal LinkedIn account, connect that to your ISU credentials so that you'll be able to get LinkedIn Learning free if you, and especially you'll want that if you're going to do the LinkedIn Learning version of the Excel assignment. Do that next week, but for now we're just going to have a look at the numbers for just a little bit, and then we'll get into the meat of the lecture, and then we can get on to the quiz. And once you're finished with the quiz, that'll be it for the day. But I'll look at the markets very quickly here. We have a situation which is, it shouldn't happen hardly ever, but it's been happening quite frequently the last couple of weeks. It is when you have a day, and this one is obviously a bull day. See all the green? Now, typically, whether it's a bull or a bear day, the least reaction will be the Dow 30. They're slow, sluggish, giant oligopolies. And then more reactive would be the Standard & Poor's 500. You've got huge companies, but many of them are in monopolistic competition. They're scrapping for their market shares and all that. And then the most reactive should be the small, higher risk companies of the NASDAQ. Interestingly enough, though, if we look at this, we will see that the Dow was up one-third of a percent. The S&P 500 should be up more, but it's not. It's up only a quarter of a percent. And then the NASDAQ is the least up at 0.21%. So it's an exact inversion of what we would normally expect to see, what we always do see, except when we don't. And that those odd ones happen, you know, when I do this course, maybe 3-4 times in the semester. Here, it's just happening day after day. So the question is, why? Now we have to say, okay, what is going on? Why is this happening? The best explanation that I have, and it's, and there are some other analysts who are kind of in agreement, is that the current policies in Washington, the only real beneficiaries are huge corporations. They are the ones who will get the most out of that big, beautiful bill and all of the deregulations and all that. The companies that are not at the top of the food chain will get benefit less and less the smaller the companies are. And that is about the only explanation we've got right now about why we see this inversion of reactions in the marketplace. Now, looking around the world a little bit, you can see that we had a mixed bag over in Asia. The Nikkei was up, but not spectacularly today. And then the Hang Seng was down. Now, Nikkei is, of course, Tokyo Exchange, Nikkei 225. Hang Seng is China. And so we see that Japan is in a fairly bullish mood. China, on the other hand, isn't in such a bullish mood. They are taking the brunt of damage from the tariffs. They are trying to find ways and markets to get by in a high tariff, in the high tariffs that have been put up by the U.S. And so they're going to show weakness. Their markets are not going to be happy. They see their revenues declining, profits declining, all that good stuff. So they are not going to be in a very bullish mood at this time. Now, going over to Europe and looking at just one of these, the Euro index, you'll see that it was down. It started out really down. And then it crawled back, trying to get back above the closing yesterday, all day today, and it never did quite do it. It came close, though, but still it ended down for the day a little bit. But then you look at the FTSE, London started out a little bit bullish, but through the day it just slowly went down as negative information just kept pouring in, beating out the positive information. So you have kind of a tepid day in London, just a little on the bearish side. Then you come over here, and we had an up day. It's not spectacular, and as you can see, obviously the biggest beneficiary was the Dow, but it was up only 0.33%. So there is weakness even in the American exchanges and stocks right now. It's nothing terrible right now, but it'll probably get worse as time goes on. That's what we're anticipating. Some are saying that we will be in a recession within 1 to 2 quarters. I'm on the side that we are already in the recession right now. With the data that we can rely on that's coming out, we see great serious job opportunity weakness, and we see manufacturing weakness. So where are we? We're certainly not in a great place. Whether or not we're really in a recession depends upon what analysts you're talking to. But anyway, going down here just for a few moments, crude is still way down. This is not an environment where you're going to have drill, baby, drill. The typical oil person is going to say, screw that. These oil prices are not just, can't justify going into the field, digging the wells, putting up the pump jacks and all the good stuff for that, and the oil reserve tanks and the pipes and the fittings and all that. It's just not worth it right now. We are not making enough on a barrel of oil to pull more oil out of the ground. And oil is expensive to pull out, especially in a lot of cases. In some cases, you're doing workouts. Others, you're having to frack the oil and all that. That's expensive stuff. This is not the kind of price that can encourage a lot of drilling. And we're just going to have to wait and see when that supply will diminish so much that the price will begin to go back up. It's not going to be very soon, though. Now, in another vein, here's something that's a little concerning to me. Gold, you might remember that I said that there is a concern. If we see $3,500 an ounce per gold, that is an indication of some serious negative sentiments in the market. Gold goes up during bad economic times. Gold also goes up when there is an expectation of future inflation, because gold is a hedge against inflation. Right now, we have a Fed that has been put under pressure to print money. And if they print money, ultimately, if there's not economic activity to sustain and use that extra money, it will turn into inflation. That's the expectation, is that we're going to see a burst of inflation, probably not until next year, early next year, will we see a burst of inflation from all of this excess liquidity that is now being pumped out by the Fed under pressure from the administration. Let me show you something. I'm going to revisit one stock right now. This was INTC, Intel. Now, Intel has taken some pretty serious hits over the last week or so since the administration said it was going to take a 10% stake in Intel. That was seen as a negative by the markets. However, you're going to see here today is a good example, but let me look over the last month. You see that there was a negative, and then there was what we call bargain hunting, when a stock, a lot of times in the real life of trading, and I'll talk about market efficiency and all that, but in real terms, when there's negative information, oftentimes traders will overreact, sell. And on the other hand, if there's positive information, they will overreact, buy. And then sober minds will begin to come in. Like during a sell-off, what you can see is it'll sell to a price way down, and then bargain hunters will come in and snatch up the stock. I do it myself. If I see an overreaction, then that's a time to buy, because the traders going ape crap over it will be selling it off too fast, too much, too hard, and then that's a chance to buy. This is probably one of those where we're seeing a recovery. As a matter of fact, there are some people who trade on that. They see a negative day that where the stock price just drops through the floor because of some bad information, and they just buy in because they know it's going to go back up. There's going to be a bounce on it. And this is what's probably happening with Intel right now. However, just to emphasize, and I'm doing this for the purpose of showing you another company, but right now, Intel is losing money hand over fist. Negative $4.77 per share they lost. Their earnings were massively negative, and on a per share basis, that's negative $4.17. They lost money for their shareholders. Now, when it's a negative, there will not be a PE ratio reported because it doesn't mean anything in negative price in negative earnings if the earnings are negative. However, we do see this is a risky stock, 1.22. That's about the threshold of a normal investor. You get much above 1.22, and you're more into the world of the kinds of professionals who want to possibly make money, but they can also afford to lose money too. And so it's right there in that shadow area of riskiness that we would want to avoid. They don't pay a dividend, which means that the only way that a stock investor can make money off this stock is if the price of the stock goes up. Now, there are reasons to be negative, bearish on Intel, letting the government get involved in a private corporation. But there are also positives. Intel is building enormous facilities here in the United States. As a matter of fact, not far from a place I lived for some of my childhood, it was a hillbilly hick town. It was just like out in the sticks. They, a couple of years ago, just bought up all the land, and they put up these insanely huge factories there in that place in Ohio. And it's just like, okay, that is good news. If there are tariffs and they've got facilities here, they aren't going to be affected by the tariffs. That's really bullish news. So I think probably they are maybe, realistically, maybe undervalued, because this is going to keep Intel sort of immune to the tariffs, where they'd have to pay tariffs to get their materials into the United States. They're building so they don't have to worry about importing. However, one way or the other. Anyway, let me show you something here. Now, Intel is an oligopoly. It's one of those companies, there are very few in the business, and oligopolies don't operate like normal companies, like S&P 500 companies, things like that. They don't look at short-run scenarios. Their entire plan is strategic. As I described it in economics classes, your normal companies are in a battlefield where melee weapons are quite popular. Oligopolies are on this vast chessboard with just a few other pieces off in the distance in their places. Those are the fellow oligopolists in that industry. So we can't really talk about them in the normal ways. However, does anyone know who Intel's main competitor for chips is? Yeah.
Just gonna throw this out there, GE.
No, they're trying. They're trying. They really are. And that's a good point. That there are some that are reaching in now. They're not established. Any suggestion? You may not have even heard of it. Yeah.
NVIDIA?
No. Okay. NVIDIA is actually getting into bed with the company I'm looking for. It's NVIDIA is, of course, ginormous. Graphics cards were their well-known product for decades, and they're now reaching into a world where they're claiming AI. They're going to do everything AI, but everyone's saying AI. But they're getting cozy with this competitor of Intel. Anyone? It's AMD. Have you ever heard of it? American Micro Devices. American Micro Devices. They produce competing chips, and there have been all kinds of rumors and news stories about how they are trying to ally themselves in some way with NVIDIA. NVIDIA and AMD are in some way going to try to marry each other. So let's look at AMD. AMD, notice a couple of things. First of all, AMD is ridiculously risky. It's head-to-head with giant Intel. So that's definitely risk right there. And at 1.94, that is really something that only a sophisticated investor, someone who's willing to lose a lot of money or make a lot of money, is going to be willing to take on. And if you look at it, it actually is profitable. Price earnings per share is positive. So they're making money, unlike Intel. And if you look here, they are definitely overvalued. No question about that. But remember I said overvaluation can last for anywhere from days to years. So we may not be too concerned about this. They don't pay that dividend, so all you're going to do is ride the price of that stock up. If you're going to make money, it's going to have to be on the price appreciation of the stock. However, this is one of those that you would want to keep an eye on. If you're going to invest in high tech and in AI, in microchips, the new generations of microchips, which are actually some of the ones, these companies like AMD and Intel, they put out a chip. But in fact, they are working on the next 2 to 3 generations of chips at the same time they are releasing their newest chip. And so these two are already in production, in research and development for the chips that you will be using in computers in the early 2030s. And it's risky. It is risky. You're going to be throwing money, and you could very well lose your butt in these, because there will be winners, but some of these could very well just disappear from the face of the earth. So keep that in mind. Now, I want to take you on a journey here. Just a couple of quickies. Let's talk about industries that are not particularly cyclical. In other words, they don't go up when times are good. They don't go down when times are bad. Like consumer goods. A company that makes toilet paper is going to be a safe company, because you're not going to stop using toilet paper if economic times are bad. Similarly, for basic foods, companies like General Mills. But let's talk about some other companies you might not think of as being safe. In other words, low beta. Let's try LMT. Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin makes the machinery of war. That's what they do. And war is always in business. Look at their beta. That gives you an idea. it's a safe stock. Why? Because there's always going to be a war, hopefully a bunch of wars. And so these kinds of companies tend to be, actually, some people might think this doesn't make sense. It makes all the sense in the world. Their products are always in demand all over the world, here and abroad. So there you go. There's a nice, safe company, insanely high earnings per share, and actually, they're a little undervalued now, too. They pay a nice, fat dividend. Yeah, it's kind of expensive per share, but you can't go wrong if you bet on war. So, yeah, go ahead.
So are, like, all the, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, tech stocks the same, or is it like there's a difference?
You got to watch it a little bit. Most of them are very secure in their contracts, in their certainty that they're going to get buyers, that there's going to be demand for war machinery, and all of that. So they are actually, to a certain extent, very similar. Although, if I recall right, some of them have somewhat higher betas than others do. But the one I pull out, Lockheed Martin, because it's a classic example of it produces a basic necessity of life. Just like General Mills produces cereals, just like Kellogg and Pfizer and all those companies, very safe stocks. Now let's talk about our world. In 45 years ago, when I would have taught this, yes, I taught it that long ago, so screw you. Good, you're old. Knock it off. I would have brought up Kellogg, General Mills, you know, companies like that. These days, you have to expand your thinking about what is a basic product. So let me bring up AT&T. A beta of only 0.62. Why is AT&T? Oh, well, let's do another one. Verizon. A beta of 0.36. What is it that they sell that is a necessity of life?
Telephone coverage.
Telephones, yes. Phones. Those things that you cannot live without. If someone took away our telephones right now, our mobile phones, probably we'd start killing each other, you know, in this room. That's how serious it is. These have become so fundamental that they have become super safe beta stocks because they are basics of life. And that's one of the things you want to think about. If you're looking for low betas, think about what in the modern world is so necessary for us to have. And then you're probably going to find low betas on those. And it will not be the same things that we would have talked about in my early years of teaching, even when I was teaching in the early 2000s. I mean, bets on internet would have been extremely high beta, and a lot of them collapsed. Now it's a completely different landscape. Google and all of those kinds of companies, they are basics of life. A lot of people can't live without Googling something. You don't do it in a test in my class, for heaven's sakes, but overall it is just super safe, those kinds of investments. And I'm doing that just to give you a background sense of what is behind numbers. I'm always harping on you, bitching at you about, let's look at the numbers. But then you have to ask yourself, why? What are these numbers telling us? That distinguishes you as a truly adult, academic, scholarly person ready to do the corporate world, and the common people who just look at things and they think, well, that's interesting. Now let's move on to dinner. Okay, enough of that. Let me know when we get to 4:10, okay? In my world, you have two kinds of animals. You have those who need money. They don't have money or capital. Remember, there's a difference between money and capital. We call those deficit economic units. And on the other side, we have things that have money or capital. Those are surplus economic units. The world is an ocean of both of these. And in fact, you can be a deficit and a surplus economic unit at the same time. I am a deficit economic unit with respect to buying a car. But I'm a surplus economic unit if someone needs $20 for a couple of days. So you can be both at the same time. But in the world I'm talking about here, the amount of capital and money needed on any given day would be measured in the quadrillions of dollars. It's insane trying to track all of the transactions that are going on. So how do we match deficit and surplus economic units? That's called financial intermediation. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. In other words, getting them together. However, there have to be three pillars, three criteria, in order for a financial intermediation to work. So the definition has to include, has to say, okay, financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economics, deficit units. Taking into account, first of all, the level, that's a fancy word for amount, of funds needed. That's the first one. I might have $100, you need $200, I can't help you. But so it'd have to be the same amounts on both sides, the party and the counterparty. The next one would be the timing. I might be willing to lend you $1,000 for a year, and you say, I kind of need that for like 10 years. So that one wouldn't work. So the timing has to match. And then there's a third one, the risk. I might, look at you. You, sir, ask me for $100. Well, I've got $100. Level's good. And you want to pay me back in a month. Well, months is good, cool for me, okay? But then I look at your credit score, and I've never seen a negative credit score. So the risk is there. I say, yo, bruh, you know, go somewhere else. You know, not here, not me. So in other words, the financial intermediation is matching of surplus and deficit economic units, taking into account level, timing, and risk. That's a classic exam question. Just put a bunch of criteria and find the three that are the right ones. I won't do this on this quiz, but it's certainly an easy question, and it's an easy question to get right, too. This is in our world now an engine. The matching is just so fast. I went to the credit union a while back, and I said, "Look, I'm thinking of getting a Ridgeline." And they said, "Okay, how much are you looking at?" I said, $45,000. They said, "Okay, we can do that. And what do you want to do?" I said, "Well, how about 5 years?" Cool. And then they looked at my credit rating. Well, the hell with that car then. Move that truck. But no, it worked just that fast. On another level, I'm going to time it's too late to do it because it's full in here. It's just too full. In another one, I teach in other countries. Now, I was down in Panama a couple of years ago when Panama was seeking to borrow on, I think it was 20-year bonds, about $2 billion. It was just some insane amount of money, of capital. And they put them out that this bond is going to go live. They're going to sell it. In other words, they're going to have looking for a lender or lenders to buy this issue. And they put it up. Within 10 minutes, it was fully subscribed. Both of them for a total of, it was something like $2 billion. It happened in minutes. Who was the buyer, the lender? It was China. China just, like that. Suddenly, that massive amount of funds, just financial intermediation happened that fast on that, on all of that capital. And of course, why did the Chinese do it? Level timing and risk. They also, of course, have, these bonds were denominated in dollars because Panama's currency is attached to ours. And so China has trillions of US dollars from all the cheap stuff we buy from them. They keep it in their foreign reserve. And so it just, it was like 10 minutes. That much was transferred. Bonds transferred to the Chinese, funds transferred to the Bank of Panama, or whatever it was, wherever it was they sent that money. So that gives you an idea of just how efficient this system is now in our time. Now, as far as institutional sources of funds go, the classic is what is called a commercial bank. Now you are, and there are of course also credit unions. I should mention those. They're in the business of being one of the parties to a financial intermediation. They get in funds through deposits and all that kind of stuff, and then they make loans. Yeah, I have to move here. Another one, which is not, they do not compete with commercial banks. They are a completely different kind of bank, are the investment banks I told you about in the last lecture. They take public offerings of common stock and they just buy all the stock in the primary market. Then they sell it to the public. Those are investment banks. You can't walk into an investment bank and say, I'd like to open a checking account. They're not that kind of a bank. They are huge. Some are all over the world. They got branches all over the world. Other ones, they are within the United States, often called regional IBs, regional investment banks. They might have offices in Chicago, New York, and LA, and possibly other places. But nonetheless, these are the surplus economic units. When companies are at a deficit economic unit and they want to sell stock to get capital. A couple of others I'll just bring up really quickly here, and this financial services firms. Financial services firms offer one stop for everything. You can, you know, make deposits, withdrawals by CDs, you can get loans through them. Wealth management services. They are a good example. Citigroup is the holding company for Citibank. Those are commercial banks. They also have branch, they also have financial services that they can provide through different names, slightly different names. They are a financial services firm, like a one stop for everything. Then you have a couple of odd animals in here. Mutual funds. You buy ownership, it's not really shares, ownership units in a mutual fund, and then they use those funds to go out and buy stocks and bonds. And their portfolio shifts, you know, they manage them. But one that sounds kind of like it, and I've talked about it before, it's not. electronically traded funds. They generally buy fixed portfolios, and then they provide those funds to purchase stocks. You buy a share of an ETF, and then that ETF uses that money to buy more shares of what is in its portfolio. Two last ones, just to get them on the table, are hedge funds and private equity. Now, I talked a little about hedge funds. Remember when I was telling you about how we can level out the income of farmers or trucking companies by hedging their price risk for some cost they have or some revenue they have? Well, that's what hedge funds do. That's their thing. They absorb risk that businesses don't want. They take the other side of it, and they help these companies stabilize their cash flows. They kind of get a dirty name, a bad name, somewhat unjustifiably, because they kind of get mixed up with they kind of get confused in some people's minds with private equity. Private equity funds are evil. They are extraordinarily successful. What they do is they take companies that are in trouble, and then they come to the rescue of those companies with tons of capital. They take a debt interest and an equity interest, and then ultimately, in the end, they destroy the companies. An example of recently, Joann Fabric, a private equity firm, just simply stepped in and took over because its sales were somewhat weak, and they rode it, milked it, and then they drove it into bankruptcy. They were the cause. And so, yeah, and another one, Staples. I could name you hundreds of companies. Private equity goes in and they set up all this rescue. We're going to save the company. They lend them huge amounts of money. They get stock as part of the compensation. And then they pump up the stock price by saying, we've taken over and we're going to get everything good. And once they pump the stock price up enough, then they sell off their equity stake. And then when the company begins to falter again because they're really not helping the company at all, then the company eventually can't pay their interest payments on the debt the private equity firm has put on them. And then they liquidate the company. It works every time. It's just beautiful. Yes. Okay, let me give you a kind of a... There was a... say, we talked about this, and as a matter of fact, this was in a movie. There was a newbie who had become part of a private equity firm, and he saw what the partners were doing, and he said, why are you wrecking this firm? And this partner just snapped back at him, because it's wreckable. You see, this is where the hole has to be there. If you see weakness, you go after it. We look in the sky, oh, isn't that a beautiful hawk? Hawks usually kill baby rabbits and old rabbits. That's the predatory way, and that's part of capitalism, a constant renewal through destruction. And we let this happen with our laws. And you have those who stand up and say, well, this has got to stop. In a way, yes. Otherwise, let's be honest with ourselves. We're predators. And although we may weep in the short run, we celebrate the new that rises out of the ashes. Okay, that's all I have for you today. I want you to now open up that quiz and take it. And then you can leave.